Good morning, this is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. I had to go to the mall last week, and while I was there, I dropped in on Walden Books to pick up a new copy of Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury. As I plopped it on the counter, the 20-something young man at the cash register said, "Hey, I just reread this book, straight through, 4 hours, couldn't stop." I chose to interpret that as an encouraging sign for the literacy and taste of his entire generation. I think just about everyone has read something from Ray Bradbury. I didn't confess that I'd never actually read Something Wicked This Way Comes, but I have read The Martian Chronicles, Fahrenheit 451, The Illustrated Man, R is for Rocket, and a whole bunch of other great Ray Bradbury books. He's written at least 51 and counting. His latest book is From the Dust Returned, A Family Remembrance, published by William Morrow, and the official publication date is, I believe, today. And appropriately so, because From the Dust Returned is by turns spooky, poetic, chilling, entertaining, and just plain eerily beautiful. Basically, it's perfect for Halloween. To talk about his latest book, and I'm sure a lot of other topics, we're honored to have with us for this hour, Ray Bradbury. As we talk with Ray Bradbury, you are welcome to join the conversation. Your questions and comments are invited. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, the rest of the country, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. If you match the letters with the numbers, that's what you get. And toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Just briefly, a bit more about Ray Bradbury. In case you didn't know, he was born in Waukegan, Illinois, and many of his stories take place in and around a place called Greentown, Illinois. Although he's been described as a science fiction and fantasy writer, his many short stories and novels stretch well beyond those genres. He's been awarded the Nebula Award, the O. Henry Memorial Award, the Benjamin Franklin Award, the World Fantasy Award for Lifetime Achievement, the Grandmaster Award from the Science Fiction Writers of America, and the Penn Center West Lifetime Achievement Award, among others. Last November, he received the National Book Foundation Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. He's been nominated for an Academy Award and has won an Emmy. He's written poetry, done theater, screenplays, you name it. He was the creative consultant on the U.S. Pavilion at the 1964 New York World's Fair and on the design of the spaceship Earth display at the Epcot Center. I could spend the next hour describing his achievements, but I'll get out of the way and let's say good morning to Ray Bradbury. Good morning. Are you there?
All I have to do is say thank you and hang up. That's the best introduction I've ever had. Thank you.
Well, thank you, but please don't hang up.
Okay, I won't.
Well, we're very glad to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, yes.
Well, let's begin, if it's okay with you, by talking about this new book, From the Dust Returned. What a great Halloween story.
Well, I'm very pleased, and I'm pleased that my publishers have allowed the book to be published on this this day. This is my favorite holiday, and I hope it's going to do well.
I'm sure it will. It is a terrific storyline.
Well, thank you. It all began about 55 years ago. I wrote a short story called Homecoming and sent it to Weird Tales. I was one of their standard writers. I appeared in almost every issue of Weird Tales for many years. They paid me $15 or $20 a story. Sometimes I got $30. But when I sent this one story in, they rejected it because it wasn't weird enough. They wanted something much more peculiar, like Edgar Allan Poe. So I wondered what to do with the story, and I looked around, and Mademoiselle magazine at that time was publishing fiction, so I decided, what the heck, I'll try it with them. Well, they held the story for some months, and then wrote to me and said, we didn't know how to change the story, so we're going to change the magazine and turn it into an October issue with your story at the center. And they got Charles Adams, the cartoonist illustrator, to do a fabulous painting for the story, which appeared then. And that painting, which I bought from him 55 years ago, is the jacket design on the new book.
It's a wonderful, wonderful painting. And you continued that collaboration with Charles Adams from that point.
Well, we wanted to do a book together. We planned on my writing a series of stories and having Charles Adams illustrate them. But years went by. I got busy on many things. He got busy creating his own household of the Adams family, which became famous in the New Yorker magazine, and then on television, and then in motion pictures. So he went his way, and I began to write a series of stories, which fused together to make this novel.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, it's like I say, the storyline is terrific, but it reads like poetry.
Well, I grew up loving poetry. I've been influenced by the best poets, Emily Dickinson and Robert Frost and Shakespeare and Alexander Pope. And when you read these poets constantly, and if you read in the theater, I've been deeply influenced by the work of George Bernard Shaw. And then again, I've been careful to read in various fields of anthropology and archaeology. So I fell in love with ancient Egypt when I was very young, and that begins to appear in all of my books.
It seems to me that you must have a great love of language and a joy of writing. And the words come out in such interesting combinations that it must be just amazing to be able
It's a genetic gift. It's developed over a period of years, but I started with that. And I always wanted to write poetry in one form or another that people could recite and people could remember. So a lot of my stories are metaphorical or based on metaphors. So it's very easy for people to remember a story that I tell them when I tell it as the ancient writers used to write, or the people of the 19th century. You read Nathaniel Hawthorne or Melville or Poe, it's very hard to forget their stories because they wrote mythically. They wrote fantasy quite often, and the stories linger in your mind.
You've said that you were a born collector of metaphors. Can you talk about what is the importance of metaphors?
Well, if you can compact an idea into a single image, then you have the ability of causing people to remember what you write. So much fiction that's been written in the recent years is so realistic, there are no metaphors, and people forget the book as soon as they put it aside. I'll give you an example. Many years ago, I was walking with my wife along the beach in Venice, California, and we came upon the ruins of the old Venice Pier, which had just been torn down. There in the sand lay the skeleton of the roller coaster. I looked at that and turned to my wife and said, "I wonder what that dinosaur is doing lying here on the beach." She was very careful not to answer, and the next night, in the middle of the night, I heard a foghorn blowing, woke up and listened to it, and said to myself, "My God, that's it. The dinosaur heard the foghorn blowing, thought it was another dinosaur calling from a billion years of dreams, and swam for an encounter with the other dinosaur. When it discovered it was only a lighthouse and a damned foghorn, it tore the lighthouse down and died of a broken heart on the beach. And that's what those bones are doing, lying here." I got up the next morning and wrote The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, which became The Foghorn in one of my books. And that one story changed my life because John Huston read that metaphor of the foghorn and the dinosaur and gave me the job of writing the screenplay of Moby Dick. So that shows you what metaphor can do for one's life.
My goodness, that's wonderful. Well, our lines are just about all full, and I promised that I would let our callers talk to you. So why don't we go ahead and include them in our conversation?
Yes, please do.
All right. We'll go first to a listener in Bourbonus, depending on how you pronounce it, on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Thank you for this program. It seems to me readers who recognize the force of an English sentence are both fans of Ray Bradbury and imitators of his method of composition. Somewhere in a three-year-old issue of Wired magazine, there's a masterful Bradbury quotation, and the National Public Radio version has to read, quote, "Put me in a room with 100 writers on their computers, and I'll out-create every beep of a beep in the room," unquote. love his crusty reliance on a pencil and a yellow legal pad. This is my heartfelt compliment. I'll give this line over to another fan. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
That's a wonderful quote. And it's true. You know, people think there are special tools you need for writing. Well, you don't. You don't need a computer. It's a typewriter. It's a special kind of typewriter. You don't even need a typewriter. All you need is a pad and a pencil or a pen. 2 months ago, I wrote a complete screenplay of 150 pages with a series of pens and a pad of white paper. And it took me about 2 weeks of sitting there scribbling, and I wrote the screenplay. So the way you approach writing is not important, as long as you write with great passion.
Sounds to me like you write constantly. I read one interview where you described the urgency of writing a book with the phrase literary appendicitis.
Well, it should be crazy passion. And I began to write when I was 12 years old, and I've never stopped because it's great fun. I don't understand writers who say writing is a terrible agony and lots of work. If it were work, I would never do it. So I can hardly wait each morning. I just got out of bed a few minutes ago, and I came up with a wonderful ending for a screenplay I've been working on for many years, and it came to me while I was shaving. So I can hardly wait to get off the phone now and go finish this.
Well, we'll let you do that in a little bit, but let's let's talk with some more listeners here, and we'll go next to someone in Mahomet on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I feel very timid about talking to you in this forum, but I feel like I can't pass up the opportunity because you've given us so many gifts.
Thank you. Thank you.
I wanted to thank you also for my dad, who introduced me to you when I was a child with Dandelion Wine and Martian Chronicles. And I haven't stopped reading you since because you've been so prolific. But I wanted you to comment a little bit about the poem Joy is the Grace We Say to God.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Particularly because, though I'm not terribly religious, that poem sort of says something different than a lot of your other works. And
no, we in many ways, we personalize God much too much. What I'm trying to say in that poem is that all of us are born just once. We go through life just once. And during that lifetime, we are privileged to be alive in the mystery of being. So you've got to pay back, don't you?
Yes.
So if you find a thing to do in your life that's wonderful and creative, no matter on what small ground you work, that is the payback. You give back to creation what you've been given. So I've always felt very privileged to be alive just once, and I always wanted to find ways to pay back. And so that when I left the world, I left it a little happier than when I came in. And that's what that poem is all about.
Well, thank you so much.
Sure. God bless.
Thank you for the call.
Bye.
We're talking during this hour, Focus 580, with the esteemed and prolific writer Ray Bradbury. His latest book, published today, From the Dust Returned, by William Morrow. That's the publisher. The author is our guest, Ray Bradbury. We have a caller waiting, and some lines open if you'd like to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you are hearing us, 800-222-9455. We'll move on to our next caller in a minute, but I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about your views on science fiction. I think some sci-fi writers think of themselves as imagining future possibilities, some of which have even come true. I'm thinking of Arthur C. Clarke's satellites in geosynchronous orbit and so forth. But you've said your job is not to predict the future, but to prevent it.
Well, at times that's true, especially with a novel like Fahrenheit 451. In which I talked about the influence of television on people and also on our lack of education. During the last 40 years, we've neglected our schools. We no longer teach reading and writing intensely, and I've always believed that if you don't learn reading and writing in the kindergarten and first grade, you're not prepared for the other grades, and you're a burden to the educational system. So we've got to change that in the next few years so we don't raise a generation of morons, which would be the kind of people I had in Fahrenheit 451. So I wrote a novel 50 years ago, which in many ways predicted the situation we're in right now, where television dominates too much of our lives, where we live our lives by the images that we see on the local and international news, and we're neglecting our ability to think, which means being able to read and turn off the set on occasion and do our own thinking.
You mentioned television, and, you know, at the time you wrote Fahrenheit 451, television was just barely beginning, I believe.
Yes, it was.
You know, I guess I'm curious, did you imagine that it would turn out the way it has? I mean, or was this simply, seemed to you a neat idea to imagine, you know, what if, you know, as a way of making a point?
No, you can, in the very early years, if you watched a TV show, a news show, and you saw people in the background jumping up and down and waving their arms and trying to get attention, that is what TV is all about. People love to talk. People love to pontificate, and they like to have their opinions shown on TV. And the publicity is terrific. They don't care about the ideas. So any TV show you watch of the TV announcer, and behind him are all these people jumping up and down, calling for attention. So you could see that 50 years ago, and it's gotten worse, of course. The television shows are full of talking heads, of people giving their opinions, and you've got to be careful who you listen to, whether the opinion is worth listening to.
Let's go next to a listener in Champaign on line number one. Edgar County on line number one. Thank you. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Yes.
Mr. Bradbury, it's an honor to speak with you. I've enjoyed your work for many years. And when September 11th happened, as I guess that's the only way you can say, the short story that you had written many years ago, There Will Come Soft Rains.
Oh, yes.
And that just struck me. That's stuck in my mind since then. The absolute just sharpness of the moment and how everything is pulverized and gone. And so I use that in teaching many years ago, and I just wanted to thank you for it.
Well, my wife's responsible for that story. About 50 years ago, I was walking one night with her, and she quoted that poem to me and by Amy Lowell, and I was so impressed with it that I went home and wrote a short story to fit the poem. And that short story became the center of many virtual reality technocrats who create such rooms today, 50 years later. So I'm very pleased with that story and very thankful to my wife for causing me to write it.
Well, then I thank your wife.
Sure, thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Surely.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For the call. There's another wonderful sort of virtual reality story, The Veldt, that...
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
That sort of, I mean, it really, I think, speaks very clearly to our sort of obsession with fooling ourselves with technology and in some way, you know, becoming warped by it.
That's right, yes. I'm very pleased. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go next to a listener in Tuscola on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I, too, am a huge fan and was lucky enough to hear you speak at the University of Illinois a couple of years ago.
Oh, that was great fun. Yes, thank you.
It was great fun, and I thank you for that. I have a question about religion, the one of the earlier callers brought up, but I was thinking of a story in your collection, Long After Midnight, a story where the alien comes into the church and is hiding out and meets up with the priest, and they have the conversation. The priest's faith is waning, and they have this conversation over the baptismal font. The priest sees the alien as Christ.
Story about the ghost of Christ.
Right.
The priest has come to Mars hoping that if Christ ever returns, because the we've often spoken of the second coming.
Right.
And he wanted to be prepared for the coming of Christ, so that's why he became a priest.
Now,
all of a sudden, in the church on Mars, near the baptismal font, the ghost of Christ appears.
Right.
And then the priest is shaken and stunned by this.
Exactly.
He falls to his knees to worship. And the Christ ghost says, no, no, be careful. I'm not what you think. And he suddenly realizes he's looking at a Martian who can assume any shape or configuration that is imagined.
Right.
And the Christ ghost says, avert your gaze and let me free. And the priest said, I can't let you go. I've been waiting for your return.
Right.
Since I was young. And all of the Christians of the world have waited for your return. And he said, I'll let you go if you promise to do one thing. And the Christ ghost says, what? And the priest says, if you promise to return every Easter and visit me. And the Martian, who looks like Christ, says, yes, I will be here every Easter. Avert your gaze. And when he averts his gaze, the ghost runs to the door and out into the night, and the Martian is gone, the Martian who resembled Christ.
Right.
And the priest then goes and locks the door and lies against it and weeps because he knows he can never tell anyone about this visitation. That's one of my favorite stories.
It's one of mine, too, and I'm just curious how big a part you think religion plays in your stories, and I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
No, it's in all of my stories, because but it's a very wide and expansive concept. The universe is so big, creation is so large, we cannot encompass it. And people have often said to themselves and to me, what are we doing here? What is our function? What does life mean? And of course, what it means is, there's no use having a universe if there isn't an audience. So we are the witnesses. We have been born to witness the universe. That's a fantastic job, and we each can do it in a different way, and glory in the fact that we're alive for a certain amount of time, and we can raise our voices to celebrate the fact of being alive at all. So that's a great function. The universe cannot exist without us. We are the witnesses. We are the audience. It's a great job we have to do.
Well, thank you. And again, I'm a huge fan. Keep writing.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. We'll go right on. Our lines are full, so we'll go next to a listener on a cell phone on line number 4 next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Mr. Bradbury, I wanted to ask you about your creativity. Thomas Jefferson was rumored that he would... when he wanted to figure out problems or solutions or ideas, he would have a rock, and before he would go to sleep, he would hold this rock, and when it dropped, he would be in a twilight zone of some sort, and he would solve many of his or come up with many of his creative ideas. And I was wondering if sleep or any phase of sleep or has an importance in your creativity. Thank you.
Sure. I missed part of that question.
Your creativity, does sleep have any part in that in certain phases? When you wake up in the morning, are your ideas fresh in your head? And is this when you come up with most of your ideas, like Jefferson did?
Yeah, the early morning is the best time because you're half asleep and you're half awake. And the good ideas you have come to you when you're relaxed, or sometimes in the shower, and you get in and the water hits you and your thoughts are free inside your head. You're not being a self-conscious intellect. You're being a sort of drowsy, half-awake creator. So many of my ideas, like the one I had this morning when I was shaving, when I'm done here today, I'll go to my typewriter or a pad and pencil and I'll write the conclusion to a screenplay I've been working on for a long time, simply because the idea came to me when I was relaxed and when I was shaving.
Hope that gives the caller's question. We're a little past our midpoint with our guest, Ray Bradbury, author of so many great books, it's really hard to list them. And we are happy to have him with us. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have several callers waiting and at least one line open. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a listener in San Francisco, actually, on line number one next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hey, morning. A couple of things. One, I was just recently hearing about some of the problems with the 911 situation, hearing about the rise in the need for psychoactive drugs, prescriptions of psychiatrists are just vastly increasing. I happen to remember the old story you did called The Man in the Rorschach Shirt, and the famous psychiatrist that just kind of disappears, and someone runs into him on a bus, and he doesn't want to. He wants to remain anonymous and continue to do his work for free, and not get the heralding and credit, but he just wants to get the daily affirmations that he's doing good. So I always admired that story, and as well, just a great deal of your work. But I wanted to chide you. Some years ago, I heard you on an interview, and I can't remember the exact phrase that you gave, but I was really you were putting down the homeless, and I, as a person who has been homeless, who has lost a lot of lost a couple of children due to this poverty that we're constantly beaten around with. Exactly what's happening again. You know, the profiteers are working their magic, and essentially the poor are going to get nothing, and the profiteers are going to gain immensely from this new 911 situation. I just wanted you to, as an author that I had every one of your books as a child, and I was really, it just really turned me against you, and I wanted you to acknowledge that.
Well, do you remember what was said? I don't know.
Do you you got to quote me back to myself
right
before I can answer that. I don't believe I said anything against them. So I believe the situation is such that many of them have, they're mainly men. They turn against life. They become alcoholics. And they become very negative. It's very hard to work with them because they don't want to be helped. So.
Well, I mean, I can imagine right now, as all of this glory, the glory days of dancing off to war, a lot of young boys are being offered the opportunity to go and kill some Arabs for Christ, you know, this whole nonsense. Well, if you study the homeless, you learn that up to 60% of them are veterans, veterans of all the wars. And they, can you imagine just basically the karma that they knew that they did wrong, they followed orders blindly, that they, when they got back, now they have to do penance.
Well, there's a lot of other elements here.
Absolutely, absolutely. But as well, you know, look at the whole idea of the profiteers sending the, you know, American flags right now are being produced by slaves over in China at double time. You know, the slaves were already hard worked, and then all of a sudden they're
doing double time. You know, what we need is an hour here to discuss this, don't we?
Yeah.
And we can't do it in a few minutes.
Well, I'm sorry that...
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
But I think you're misquoting me. I've never said anything against... I'm trying to analyze certain friends that I know that were gamblers and gambled their money away in Las Vegas, or they were drunkards and they drank too much and destroyed their families. There are all kinds of motives here.
Yeah.
So, but there isn't time to go into that. But I've never said anything against these people.
Okay.
So thank you for your question.
All right. I hope that gets at least partially to the caller's point. And we have several people waiting, and I want to get on next to someone in Champaign on line number three. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning, Mr. Bradbury. Been a great fan of yours, of course, since I was little, and I have two things I want to mention. Probably the very first thing I ever read was Dandelion Wine, and the most exquisite phrase of yours that has stuck with me for nearly 45 years is describing doffing his Oxford shoes and putting on his Super Para Lightfoot tennis shoes that feel marshmallows on your feet. And it's just the most exquisite example of what it feels like at the end of winter when spring comes.
Well, that's, that particular story, that book came together because I wrote an article on making dandelion wine for Gourmet magazine back in 1953.
Oh,
I didn't realize I was beginning to write a novel. So I did a whole chapter on making dandelion wine. I did a chapter on the summer night porches. I did a chapter on ravines and how terrifying they can be at night.
Yes.
And as a result of seeing a boy jump on a bus in Westwood Village here in 1954, I saw him running in the street. He jumped on the bus, ran down the aisle, slammed himself into a seat, and I said, oh, my God, if I had that young boy's energy, I could write a novel every month.
And oh, my.
I looked at his feet, and he was wearing the brightest pair of new tennis shoes I'd ever seen, and I was hit by lightning, and I said to myself, my God, I remember every spring when I was a kid, my father taking me downtown and getting rid of my heavy winter shoes, putting on the new pair of Lightfoot tennis shoes so I could run away from my enemies and run to greet my friends on the hills of summer. And I got off the bus and went home and wrote the short story, The Sound of Summer Running. Out of these adventures and these encounters, I finished the book Dandelion Wine and published it in 1957. So all of these essays, all of these poems, turned into a novel.
So
I'm very lucky to have this sort of encounter create stories for me.
The other thing I wanted to mention is when I was in college, I graduated in 1971, one of my good friends who sat next to me in organic chemistry was a lady by the name of Mary Foley from Waukegan, Illinois.
That's right.
And she brought to my attention a short story of yours called The Black Ferris.
Yes, yes.
She mentioned her grandmother Foley sitting on the porch.
That's right, yes. Yeah, with that story, that short story became a novel, Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Yes.
So I was very fortunate that these stories suddenly, like you drop a Japanese flower into a glass of water, and they blossom and become large, large blossoms indeed.
The sacredness of the word is just wonderful, and I feel so fortunate to have you to continue to write. And to
well, I'm very pleased, and thank you for calling to me.
Thanks so much for the call. Let me ask you, and I'll get right onto the callers, I promise, but I wanted to ask you about Greentown, Illinois. Where is Greentown, and why?
Well, it's Waukegan, Illinois. It's about 35 miles north of Chicago, and I grew up there. I was born there in 1920, and I lived there until 1934 when I was 14. So I was very fortunate to spend the early part of my life in a small town near a ravine where I could play all summer long and where I could ice skate in the winter. So I had a childhood that was, I suppose, a normal childhood, being in love with my environment and running to the library there, where the library became the center of my life. And then when I was 14, we moved to Los Angeles, where I fell in love with motion pictures, of course, and being around famous people and hoping someday to go over the wall into the studios and become part of the function of making incredible motion pictures. So I've been very lucky in half of my life being in a small town and the rest of my life in a city where I wanted to become part of the entire functioning industry.
And so that small town becomes a theme throughout many of your books.
That's right. It even appears on Mars. When we go to Mars, we find my small town of Greentown up on Mars.
That's great. Our lines are all full. Let's go on and talk with some more listeners. We'll go next to someone in Mahomet on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. We're calling from our English class today, and we haven't been exposed to a lot of books that Ray Bradbury has written, But one that we did learn about was Fahrenheit 451, and we were just wondering what inspired you to write that.
Well, when I was growing up, libraries were such an important part of my life. And along through my teen years, I learned about the libraries at Alexandria 3,000 years ago, which burned two or three times. On two occasions, they were accidents, and the libraries burnt down. And on the third occasion, I believe, the library was burnt on purpose. Now, when you think of that, what a tragedy it is that all that wonderful writing, many plays, and many histories were destroyed in those fires 3,000 years ago. And then in my own time, Hitler burned the books in Berlin. And we heard rumors about books being burned in Russia or destroyed in one way or another. And the same occurred in China. So to me, if you burn a book, you're burning a person. And it finally occurred to me to write a series of short stories which led up to the writing of Fahrenheit 451.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are you calling from your actual classroom?
Yeah, we're in class right now.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, we're really glad that you joined us.
Happy Halloween.
All right,
love to all of you.
Bye.
All right. Thanks very much for that. We will continue talking with some listeners, and next up is someone in Cisna Park on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm also a senior in high school, and I'm writing an author report on you.
Yes.
And so this is a great privilege to be able to talk to you.
Thank you.
I was wondering, who has influenced your writing the most?
Oh, that's hard to answer.
Yeah.
I fell in love with the fairy tales and the writing of the Grimm's fairy tales and Andersen's fairy tales and comic strips when I was 9 and 10 years old, Buck Rogers. And I began to collect the comic strips when I was very young. And then I fell in love with Tarzan of the Apes, Edgar Rice Burroughs, and John Carter, Warlord of Mars. And then all of the Oz books, L. Frank Baum's Oz books, I read over and over again when I was 9 and 10 years old. And then Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. So these great loves, there's nothing like the love that you have for certain books when you're very young. And never again in the rest of your life do you have a madness as complete as the reading experience when you're 10 years old. Because you dive into a book and you never come up. It takes your mother and father and a fire department to get you out of the book and get you to supper on a summer evening.
Mm-hmm.
So these are my great loves. These started me on the path, and when I began to write my first fictions when I was 12, I wrote sequels to the novels of Edgar Rice Burroughs and laid them on Mars. So my first Martian stories were written when I was 12 years old.
And also, I was wondering, of all your works, do you feel like you have a favorite one?
No, they're all my children. So I have 4 daughters that I love very much. I have 8 grandchildren, and I try not to play favorites. That's true of all of my books, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and another question, I was just wondering, are there any facts that you think I should include in my paper about you that maybe aren't well known?
I'm sorry, what is the question again?
Are there any facts about you that you suggest I write in your paper that I might not find doing research?
Oh, my God. You better get on the Internet right now.
I have.
I think you'll
that.
Find more there anyway, and good luck in your search.
Okay, thank okay. you.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, there are a lot of great resources on the Internet.
Yep.
So. Certainly. Well, we have a couple callers left in just about 5 minutes, so I'll try to squeeze them both in. We'll go next to someone in Urbana on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580. Hello?
Yes.
Are you there? I guess.
Yes, we are.
Okay. I think we lost that caller, so instead let's go to a listener in Urbana on line number 3. Good morning.
Yeah, speaking of the Internet, I just looked at one of a site that had a lot of your quotes, sir, and one of them makes me wonder if you might have changed your mind over the years, though it's not really cited. It's just a quote. standing by itself, and it says, since our tongues first moved in our mouths, we've asked, what does it all mean? No other question made sense with death breathing down our necks. But just let us settle in on 10,000 worlds spinning around 10,000 alien suns, and the question will fade away. And I was wondering, you know, nowadays it looks like it's going to be so difficult to make that a reality if you've changed your mind at all.
Well, I don't quite understand what the question is.
Is it essentially, is it still important to explore space? Is that what you're asking?
Oh, yeah. Do you think that's going to be the be-all for the human race? It sounds as if at one time you did think it was.
Well, it's the one endeavor we have that's creative. It's a nice substitute for war. When the whole human race puts their energy into going back to the moon and then on to Mars, that's with one purpose. So there's nothing destructive there. I think it's a very, very creative endeavor, and we have to do it because we want to survive on other planets as well as this planet that we live on here.
We have just a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about your views on the importance of books and reading to the health of a civilization.
Well, if you went to the average university and tore down all the buildings except one, the one building that should remain is the library. You've got all the sciences and all the humanities and all the various buildings, and you could tear down the buildings as long as the people were standing and they had a focus. There's one place to go, and the library is the center of any university. So you don't need the other buildings. All you need is one building, and people can come to that and sit and become philosophers or scientists or writers or whatever it is. So libraries are the center of our life, and books are the center of our life. And if we don't know that, then we will become a nation that forgets its past and has no future.
You've said you can't have a democracy without thinking carefully on paper.
That's right. The more we can teach students to write down their thoughts so they can see how dumb they are, it's very important at a very young age that you begin to put down your ideas so that 6 months later or a year later, you can see how stupid you are. And then over the years, you become, you hope, less stupid and less dumb. So writing is very important. It doesn't matter the quality of your writing. The important thing is to trap yourself in your thinking and to argue with yourself, not with other people, but with yourself, and saying, why did I think that? Well, what do I think now? So my progress in thinking has been a discovery of myself over a period of 50 years.
The new book, From the Dust Returned, is being officially published today. You also have another story collection in the works that's due this Christmas?
There's a collection coming up in the spring, one more for the road, so 20 more short stories, and also two books of poetry being published during the next few months. One is called They Have Not Seen the Stars, and it will be published here in roughly 8 weeks, and then another novel next year sometime.
My goodness.
So it's been a busy time for me.
You're not slowing down at all.
Yes, indeed.
Well, we thank you so much for talking with us. We're here at the end of our time, and I'm reluctant to let you go, but I have to make way. So we'll let you get back to finishing that story you're working on.
I'm going to go ahead for my pen and pencil right now.
Thank
you very much.
And we thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye now.
All right. Our guest, Ray Bradbury, and again, his latest novel, just released today, From the Dust Returned, published by William Morrow.